Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob, for the introduction and the hospitality. I'm very honored to be here and to talk to you about accelerator science and technology in Canada. As all of you, I'm sure, know, particle accelerators are used and enable discovery sciences in so many different fields of science, in elementary particle physics, in nuclear science, X-ray, neutron, and muon science, and in the science of accelerators themselves, as we're going to see. And furthermore, they have found broad and expanding applications in medicine, security, energy, industry. Today, we will talk about major accelerators in Canada, those that are found in TRIUMF, the National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics, and the one that is found in the Canadian Light Source in Saskatoon. And then I will talk about a new accelerator that is about to be built in TRIUMF. As Bob mentioned, this is a megawatt class electron linear accelerator. And we're going to talk about its science case and how possibilities of how to use this accelerator in the future for some different application from what it was originally conceived for the production of synchrotron radiation. And then we're going to see what it takes to realize some of these possibilities. And one of the fundamental elements that it takes is that we educate young people, like a lot of you I see in the audience, in accelerator science and technology. And that requires strong partnerships between laboratories like TRIUMF with accelerator infrastructure and universities. And I will summarize at the end. So what is an accelerator? An accelerator is a device that uses electromagnetic forces to accelerate particles, charged particles, and to also guide them around the desired trajectory and to keep them in the form of a beam, if you like. Now, to make an accelerator, you need a few things which are absolutely necessary. First, you need the source of the particles you decide to accelerate. This may be electrons, protons, ions, and so on. Then you need to accelerate those particles in vacuum. You need to have an electric field to accelerate them, and you may use either magnetic or electric fields to focus this beam of these particles into a beam, and then to also steer them around the desired orbit, and you need some controls, of course. And this is a very familiar type of an accelerator. Most of you are familiar with. It's your CRT tube in your TV, where there is a source of electrons, which are then guided through some focusing elements in a vacuum, and then hit these phosphor dots on the screen to produce light. So, accelerators, the era of accelerators, started around the 1930s. So it is a relatively modern discipline. And it started back in the Rutherford's lab in England when John Cockcroft and Ernest Walton produced the first nuclear reaction when they accelerated protons up to 800 kV and they bombarded a lithium target and they disintegrated it. So in some ways, they achieved the alchemist's dream, except they couldn't produce gold, of course. And so the way they accelerated these protons here is shown here. They used the high voltage transformer and a voltage multiplier, and they got to 800 kV. At around the same time, in Berkeley now, in California, Lawrence and Livingston were developing another type of accelerator that looks like that. This one is called the cyclotron, and it has perpendicular magnetic field, as shown here, split into these two magnets, and then the accelerated particles are bent by this field around the circular trajectory with increasing radius, and every time they cross the gap, they get an acceleration by this RF voltage. And so they keep on going until they are extracted. And by this technique, by this very first cyclotron, they were able to accelerate hydrogen ions up to 80 kV, and their very first cyclotron was 4.5 inches, and I want to show it to you here. This is the real picture of that cyclotron, and from that point on, progress took place rapidly, so they kept on going to higher and higher energies based on the cyclotron method, and so pretty soon they had a 27-inch cyclotron. They got up to 10 MeV, and so on. And of course, from that point, from the early 30s, we are here today. From the 4.5-inch cyclotron, here we have accelerators such as the Large Hadron Collider with 27 kilometers in circumference that span the border between Switzerland and France. And you are all familiar with this. And in the intervening time, we've developed many different types of accelerators, different configurations. We have more circular accelerators, such as the Tevatron, which is at Fermilab outside Chicago, 6 kilometer circumference. This is another circular machine, the Advanced Photon Source. This is in Argonne, again in Chicago, and this is used for synchrotron radiation production. This is now a linear accelerator at SLAC that has 3 kilometers, the length of the machine is 3 kilometers. And this is yet another configuration. This is a recirculating LINAC at CBAF, a Jefferson lab, where these two are the LINACs and the particles go around just 5 times and then they hit the target for nuclear physics experiments. So you see now we have different configurations, circular, linear, recirculating, and then we have so many different applications. We have colliders, such as LHC and the Tevatron, or even the SLC for particle physics, and then we also use them to produce X-rays that allow us to probe into matter and into life molecules and understand the structure and the dynamics of important molecules. Canada now has 2 accelerator labs. One is Triumph in Vancouver, and the second is the Canadian Light Source in Saskatoon that you see here. And let's go see. Let's talk first about the Triumph accelerators. This is the site map of Triumph. At the heart of the Triumph accelerators is a cyclotron, just like Lawrence and Livingston's. But this one is a 500 MeV cyclotron. And this cyclotron provides proton beams for the majority of the experimental scientific program at Triumph. There are 4 beam lines that I've marked here in blue, which direct protons to different experimental areas. This beam line directs them to what we call the meson hall for historical reasons. This is where the facility to do molecular and material science is, based on MuSR. I'll talk about that in a minute. The second beam line goes to a proton irradiation facility that includes proton therapy facility. We'll talk again about each one of them. The third beam line goes to the ISAC complex for the production of rare isotope beams for nuclear physics. The fourth beam line is presently unused. It has not been used for about 10 years, but we're about to start cleaning it up because in our next 5-year plan, we have plans to send protons down this beam line and up to a new target hall station that we plan to build over the next 5 years to increase the productivity of our nuclear science program. So let's start now to see each one of them. This is here the 500 MeV cyclotron. This is an H- cyclotron that has this 6-sector magnet, these huge magnets. You see this in 1972, this picture, as it was being built. And here is a picture more modern, where you see when the lid of the cyclotron is open and a worker here is doing maintenance inside the vacuum vault of the cyclotron. We open it up once a year to do maintenance. it's a tremendous machine and very reliable, despite its 30-some years of operation. Now, the scientific program that is enabled mostly by the cyclotron beams, by the proton beams at Triumph, has three major components. One of them is muon-based molecular and material science. Now, you know many scientists use X-rays, others use neutrons, to probe into matter and understand the structure of matter. Scientists at Triumph use muons, and the muon spin in particular, and use that as a magnetic probe based on a method called muon spin relaxation, or the R stands for resonance, and so on. How does that work? The muons are produced here, polarized in one way, and then when they hit the material that you want to probe its structure, then they precess around the magnetic field of the material. You usually probe magnets, semiconductors, superconductors, and so on. So the muons precess around the magnetic field of the material, but since they are short-lived, they decay. And they decay into positrons, and the direction that the positrons decay typically is the direction of the spin of the muon. And so by that, you can infer the properties of the magnetic field of the material. And that's how you use it as the probe. It is the only facility in the America, in the Americas, in the US and Canada, that uses this. And the other facilities are at PSI in Switzerland and in Japan. The second scientific thrust of Triumph has to do with nuclear medicine. The facilities we use for that include the following: a proton therapy facility, which is here, and we'll talk in a minute more about that, and three smaller cyclotrons with energies up to 20-30 MeV that are used for the production of medical isotopes. Those cyclotrons are owned by MDS Nordion, it's a company, but operated by us. We also have a fourth cyclotron, which is TR-13, has 13 MeV energy, that's owned and operated by us and produces medical isotopes, PET isotopes in particular. So the program that the nuclear medicine program that Triumph has in place has the following components. It revolves around PET, positron emission tomography. So we use the TR-13 cyclotron and targets to produce these PET isotopes. Those are fluorine 18, carbon 11, nitrogen 13. Those, when they decay, they emit a positron, which when it interacts with matter, with electrons, they annihilate each other, and they produce gammas. And the gammas are then detected by a PET scanner, and depending on where the positron came from, then you can tell from the scanner the abnormality in the body, essentially. And so we use the cyclotron to produce those PET isotopes, and we send some of those, we send directly to UBC Hospital or to the BC Cancer Agency. And in fact, we have a rabbit line, we call it, which is a pneumatic tube, which is 2.5 about kilometers in length, that we use to shoot them from Triumph to the hospital because they are so short-lived that we cannot afford to drive them back and forth. So that's one way to send them. And that's just production every day. But we also have facilities at Triumph in which we combine those PET isotopes with other biomolecules, like sugar, for example, to make radiopharmaceuticals, like this one is FDG. This is as if we take sugar and we label it with F18, and we inject it into the patient, or rather we send that to BCCA. And that's injected into the patient. When this biomolecule goes and finds the spot of the tumor, for example, because in some ways it needs to be fed by energy, and sugar does that, then it emits the positron, because the fluorine 18 is there, it emits the positron that is then detected, and that's how you find the place. This PET allows you not only to have to get the information about the structure. This particular one is used for brain, by the way, FDG. Not only the structure, but in real, but the way the brain works in real time in some way. So it provides dynamic information with the PET scanner in general. So this FDG is used for cancer detection and staging. Another, we make another radiopharmaceutical, that's PIB, again by combining one of those with some other molecules, and that is being used to image and develop diagnostics of Alzheimer's disease pre-mortem. So that is an experimental research stage right now, and so what they plan to do is be able to see in someone's brain and tell if there is an onset of the disease. And the ultimately, this may lead to some cure, probably. And finally, there another major discovery that based on this whole theme is that they took C11, they took dopamine and labeled it with C11, this one, and this allowed them to form the biochemical basis of the placebo effect. And so for the Alzheimer's disease, and in fact the doctor received a major award for this research that he did. Now, the third aspect of our nuclear medicine program is the proton therapy facility that I showed you earlier. So what we do there is patients who have one form of eye cancer come and get treated with these proton beams. We treat about one patient per month in collaboration with the BC Cancer Agency. And this treatment is highly successful for the patient, 95%. And it is the only facility in Canada. We now go to the third thrust of the scientific program, which is the production of rare isotope beams for nuclear physics. Now, when I say rare isotopes, I mean isotopes that live for milliseconds. They are very hard to produce, and they are very hard to measure. And Triumph is one of the facilities in the world that makes, for some of them, the highest intensity of those isotopes. And I'll show you now the scientific importance of them. So we have this Isaac 1 and Isaac 2, where the proton beam hits one of these two targets, produces rare isotope beams, they are separated, they are accelerated by normal conducting cavities here, and they are directed into this low energy experimental area and medium energy experimental area. And then, if you want higher energy isotopes, we direct them up along these S bands, and then into a superconducting heavy ion LINAC. And here is our high energy experimental area. This ISOL facility has the highest power driver beam. The proton beam is the highest power in the world, and we put up to 50 kilowatts of proton beam power on the targets. But you notice that we have, well, I should tell you that we have 14 world-class experiments on the floor in these three areas, 14 different experiments, but they are all fed by only one driver beam. And so this is a limitation. And we will address that in the next five-year plan. This is a picture of our heavy ion LINAC, linear accelerator. This is a superconducting cavity that encloses the fields that are used to accelerate the heavy ions, and we put four of them together in this structure, which we call a cryo module. There is a solenoid in between, and then we stack up these cryo modules one next to the other, and this is the LINAC. The beam is accelerated, and these are magnets here through these cryo modules. And what is this nuclear science? What do we do with these rare isotope beams? Well, the basic point is that there are some very fundamental questions that belong to the grand challenges of our century, as that report of the US National Academy articulated back in 2001. And some of these fundamental questions have to do with how did these heavier nuclei come about, from iron all the way to uranium? How do the protons and neutrons are held together to make the stable nuclei? How come some nuclei are unstable and some are stable? And there is a whole series of questions that have to do with the world around us, and some of them even with astrophysics, with the stars. But we don't know the answers yet. And so this is what we try to address. And the Isaac Scientific Program addresses these questions in this split into these four broad areas. Well, three for nuclear physics. One is nuclear structure, and these are just the names of the experiments. You'll see in a minute. Second is nuclear astrophysics, and fundamental symmetries is the third. And we also use some of the rare isotopes to do some more material science, this time with beta NMR. And I wanted to just show you, just to have a very brief overview of all the different experimental setups that we have for the different experiments. Not to explain any of them, because I don't have time. This is for Isaac too, the different experimental setups. And just to tell, And just to give you a flavor of the science one example of the nuclear structure science that we're investigating with these beams, and this is this nucleus of lithium-11. This is a very strange nucleus. It's called a halo nucleus, and there is several of them on the periodic table. And this particular one has a chorus which is the same as lithium-9, and then it has two very weakly coupled neutrons. The binding energy is so low, as a matter of fact, that they are quite far apart from the main nucleus. So far apart that the radius of this particular element, lithium-11, is almost, the RMS value of the radius is almost the same as lead-2008. And if you take one neutron away, the whole thing is going, it's unstable. But but with the two of them is stable. And they say it looks like these Borromean rings, that if you take one of them away, they are interlinked in such a way that if you remove one, the whole thing falls apart. So the same with this lithium-11. And Isaac can make the most intense beams of lithium-11 now possible. And so people are studying that very carefully. So in addition to all this, to this scientific program that's going on site at Triumph, we participate in external collaborations. And two examples is the CERN Large Hadron Collider and a new accelerator, a big program, experimental program in Japan, at JPARC, and that's the T2K experiment. And I am only going to talk about the accelerator contributions to these two projects. I know that people, even here in the audience, participate on the particle physics aspect of it, but I'm not going to talk about that. So, but there are very serious contributions there as well. So to the LHC, we have designed and built in Canada these twin aperture worm quadrupoles, in addition to some kicker magnets. And presently, this happened in the past. This was one part of our contribution. And presently, we're working on a new superconducting proton LINAC. This is an upgrade to LHC. They want to replace the existing injector complex with a superconducting linear accelerator. And we're working to understand the stability of the beam in that LINAC. And we're prototyping one of the superconducting RF cavities that are used for acceleration. and we have folks over at CERN participating in the commissioning of the LHC, which is very exciting. And on the T2K, we have our remote handling people who help with the targets of that experiment, and they go to Japan. Then this is quite specialized field as well. And we know about targets because of our ISAAC rare isotope beam program. We use targets to throw the protons on to produce the rare isotopes. Okay, let's now move to the Canadian light source. This accelerator takes advantage of a phenomenon that you all know, that when you have an electron going around in a motion and undergoing acceleration, it emits electromagnetic radiation. And so, and in fact, this phenomenon used to be a big nuisance to particle physicists who wanted to use electrons in big circular machines to do collider physics or particle physics, but they had to deal with all this synchrotron radiation that was generated. And until somebody with the foresight said, maybe we can use these X-rays that are coming out. And this field, which is very recent, has blossomed now, and there are thousands of users of the synchrotron radiation around the world, and there are many, many accelerators built on purpose to produce this radiation of very broad range of wavelengths. So CLS is one such machine, the Canadian light source, and here I want to say that in a configuration like a storage ring, what you have typically, you don't just rely on the band to produce the radiation, you put special devices called undulators or wigglers where you force the beam into a periodic transverse motion and you force it to radiate more. And so you increase what we call the brightness of the source. You have more photons coming out. And so you put these wigglers and undulators, and here you see you can have multiple users of these X-rays in one, all fed by one accelerator. And so CLS is like that. And you see here, it has a LINAC, a normal conducting LINAC, perhaps like the one you used to have in your basement. And particles then go into this booster where their energy goes from about 300 MeV to about 3 GeV. And then they are injected into a storage ring. And then there are all the undulators and wigglers. And look at all the different beam lines now that are come out to the experimental, to the end stations where they're used for science. And here is a big overview of the the CLS, and down here is the where the beam lines come out. Okay, and what do people do with those with these X-rays now? What is some examples of science that's done at CLS? It's actually fascinating. Some people look at how, for example, catalyst particles work at the molecular level. Others use the X-rays to obtain an image of the structure of a molecule. In this particular one, this is a molecule that has to do with tuberculosis. And by understanding it, it allows them to peer deeper into the source of the disease and why the bug is resilient, and to probably find a new way to treat it. Another application, also fascinating, is you all read that maybe mercury in the fish is not always good for us, and maybe not so good for pregnant women. They find out that high concentrations of mercury in tissues made up of rapidly dividing cells, in this case in the eye of newly hatched zebrafish, has important implications, allows them to understand the impact of mercury exposure in developing animals, including humans. And it's on and on and on. Broad spectrum of applications. And just to emphasize the importance of this X-ray science, I have the pictures of the 2009 Nobel Prize laureates in chemistry for unraveling the structure of the ribosome. And they did that. The ribosome is the particle physicists laugh. I don't know why. The ribosome What they the ribosome has hundreds of thousands of atoms it consists of. And they used storage rings, like synchrotron radiation rings, like the CLS. It didn't happen at CLS. I want to make that clear. But like the CLS, to generate 3D models of these atoms, and using X-ray crystallography, as they call it. And then they can also show how antibiotics bind to this so that they can develop more targeted antibiotics. Okay, now let's look into the future. And so up to now it's what is going on presently in Canada with accelerators. The major new accelerator that we plan to build in the near future is this electron linear accelerator, and I'm going to talk to you about the machine itself a little bit and about its scientific promise. Now, this electron LINAC is only one aspect of an integrated plan that Triumph has for the next 5 years. And the other elements of this plan is a new proton beam line that I showed you, the fourth one, this is unused right now, that will become a second primary driver to produce rare isotope beams, so we can exploit the 14 experimental stations with better efficiency. And two new target stations, in addition to the two we have now, so we can exploit the new electron machine and the new proton beam line by producing more rare isotopes. But the electron LINAC is this flagship facility in the next 5 year plans. And here you see it in a schematic. We're working on its design presently. We have been for a while. It has a gun, a thermionic gun that produces electrons, an injector cryomodule, followed by the two, this is the main LINAC, if you like. Each one of these two cryomodules consists of two superconducting RF cavities. It is going to be a megawatt class machine. The exact, its total energy will be 50 MeV at the end and 10 milliamperes of electron beam current. This is continuous current. And so the total beam power is half a megawatt. And it's going to operate continuously, the duty factor. That means the electron bunches will come continuously, will never stop. It is based, the design concept, on 1.3 gigahertz superconducting RF technology. And we'll talk about why this particular design offers flexibility to use it for other applications. In June of 2009, CFI announced the funding of this proposal, which was led by UVic in collaboration with Triumph, and University of Toronto was also a member of the CFI grant. Why did we choose superconducting RF technology for this machine? For several reasons. First of all, when I say these RF cavities are superconducting, I mean to say these are the cavities that have the fields in there, the electromagnetic fields with a strong longitudinal electric component that accelerate the electrons. Those are made of niobium, and we cool the niobium down to 2 degrees Kelvin. And at this temperature, it is a superconductor. And now that it's superconductor, you have very low losses on the cavity wall. So when I put RF power into this cavity, most of the power goes to accelerate the beam. Very little is wasted on the cavity walls. And therefore, we have a very efficient accelerator. And very the wall plug efficiency, the wall plug to the beam power efficiency is much higher, therefore. And furthermore, if you wanted to operate this in a continuous wave mode, that is to have the stream of electrons never to stop, you can only do with superconducting technology if you want gradients about 2 megavolts per meter. Because in a, if you use copper cavities and you want to accelerate above 2 megavolts per meter, the losses on the walls of the copper cavities are so high that you don't have enough time to cool them, basically. And so the only viable solution in CW is superconducting RF. And furthermore, from beam dynamics, SRF provides a very provides beam stability that normal conducting doesn't. Okay, for reasons that have to do with the converter, that so the electrons are going to go to fall on a converter, to produce photons, and those photons will hit a target, maybe uranium or something else, to produce the rare isotopes that we want via photofission. That process is called photofission. So the converter now, for a half a megawatt beam power, is highly non-trivial. And right now, we don't exactly know how to do it. We know how to do up to 50 kilowatts, because we're doing it. We think we know how to do 100 kilowatts, and we'll test it pretty soon in France. But we don't know yet how to do half a megawatt. For that, we have staged the LINAC project. So we say at about 2017, we're going to be at the final machine, 50 MeV, half a megawatt. And by 2013, we're going to go only to 30 MeV and 100 kilowatts of beam power. And then, in order to be able to do some system integrations tests, we plan by 2011 to test up to 35 kilowatts the injector cryomodule and up to 5 to 10 MeV energy in the injector. And we're working towards that goal now. The advantage of the eLINAC is, the advantages are multiple. For nuclear physics, first of all, it gives high intensity, clean, neutron-rich isotopes. Clean, I mean, with very low isobaric contamination. And this is the name of the game, as Ted can tell you. And neutron-rich, with protons, you get proton-rich isotopes. Now we're going to expand to the other side of the stability line. We'll get more time for, we'll be able to produce isotopes for beta NMR, lithium-8 and beryllium-9. It's a new source for us. And furthermore, it positions TRIUMF to play a role in developing the medical isotope Moly-99. We have ideas of how to use this for accelerator-based Moly-99 production, which is very much in the news nowadays. Now, here is where the science of the LINAC is captured. The ISAAC nuclear science in 2015 and beyond. So from the protons from the cyclotron uranium carbide target, we produce in the proton-rich isotopes and low-intensity neutron-rich. This is protons versus neutrons. And using now the photofission with the LINAC on uranium targets, we produce neutron-rich isotopes in these regions here. This is the TIN-132 I was saying, and this is nickel-78, I think. And so you see that the combination of the two drivers now, the protons and the electrons, allow us to span most of this of the stability region and push out in all directions. The LINAC is very important for accelerator science as well, because it allows us to learn how to do SRF cavities and to become good in SRF technology, because most of the accelerators around the world nowadays are based on this technology. And so by us becoming an expert in it, we can go out and help other help build machines from around the world and participate in other projects. And finally, it is a path to light source applications. And to spend a minute on SRF development, that's how we see the development at TRIUMF. We started with the ISAAC II superconducting cavities. This is what we built now. This is a single cell cavity for the LINAC. This is what we do for the CERN upgrade. And this is what we hope to do one day, a cavity for the International Linear Collider, which is very challenging to do. And our aspiration is that we become a center for SRF science and technology. And in these aspirations, we have good help from University of Toronto. We collaborate with people here. And here you see a picture of Bob and of William, who spent a year sabbatical with us working on superconducting RF. And here you see two contributions of the U of T. This is the cryostat is a little test apparatus that we put single cell cavity and we measure essentially the fields, the gradient that it can operate at. And what U of T folks did were they designed and made a variable coupler and an antenna to feed the power in and measure it on the other side. And this is a bit pool measurement. I don't want to go into details that they want to have here, and they are working to design that by stringing a bead through this superconducting cavity, it modifies the fields in the cavity, and then if you measure it with a network analyzer, it allows you to be able to make the distribution of the field more uniform by retuning each cell of this cavity, essentially. So that's what they're working on. And so I told you that the LINAC opens up a path to use it as a light source. And let's talk about this possibility now for a minute. So the light source, the synchrotron radiation users, it's a very large community, and they always ask for more quantity and quality of synchrotron radiation. And the following characteristics, if you like, are very important for these new applications. The first is they want more spectral brightness. Brightness means that they want more photons, essentially, in very simple terms. Because more photons implies that their experiments are going to take a lot shorter to be done than with less photons. And shorter means it becomes practical to use X-rays as probes and to study these hundreds of thousands of atoms, for example. You need a lot of photons to do something like that. They need coherence. That means they want the spot sizes to be very small and very confined of the order of the wavelength of the radiation itself. That allows them to probe into complex structures and be able to model the structure much better. They want short pulses, both short electron pulses and short then X-ray pulses, because that allows them to study to take what I call X-ray movies, to study the dynamics of complex molecules, not just the structure, but also how fast it evolves. It's like you take a movie with very fast X-ray pulses, a series of snapshots. And finally, they want broad wavelength, therefore tunability. Up to now, it was the storage rings, the circular machines that we talked about, that were used with these undulators or wigglers, the insertion devices that were used to produce X-rays. This technology is very well developed and very well understood, but as a result, it has reached a limit. It's fundamental limits in some ways. One of these limits comes from the synchrotron radiation phenomenon itself. So what you have there is you have a combination of quantum excitation because of synchrotron radiation and radiation dumping. And the two of them, if you do the derive the equations, mean that you end up with a certain emittance in the beam. The phase space, if you like, distribution of the electron beam is set. You cannot lower that. And also the same is true for the longitudinal extent of the bunch. the band length, as we call it. You cannot make it shorter than a certain value because of synchrotron radiation. And that's a limitation, because the users want shorter and shorter. Storage rings cannot provide that. And there are issues with the lifetime of the beam in those rings. So then you say, maybe I go use a linear accelerator, because in a linear accelerator, the beam doesn't undergo synchrotron radiation, and therefore it doesn't have those limitations. And that is true. However, if you were to accelerate the 100 milliamps of current, average current that you do in a storage ring, you need half a gigawatt of power to power it. You need a nuclear power plant to power the accelerator. So it doesn't work. So what do you do? There is an alternative. And this is this concept of the energy recovery LINAC, which works as follows. So here you have electrons injected into this LINAC, linear accelerator, almost on crest. So they receive maximum acceleration as they go through. And then they're bent around a magnetic arc, a bunch of magnets. And then they go through some device that wiggles them in some way to generate photons. Okay. So you take the light out and you give it to the users. And the beam quality is very good up to now, right? That's what the users see. Because it went through very fast once through the LINAC. Nothing degraded the beam quality. Now, you take the spent beam out and you send it around another arc and back into the same cavity, but this time you go 180 degrees out of phase. And now what the cavity sees, it sees a vector, I1 if you like, which is on crest. I think of beam current as vectors. This is maybe at roughly 0 degrees, and then this one is at 180 degrees. So the accelerating and decelerating beam currents effectively cancel each other. So then I don't need any RF power independently of the amount of beam current I accelerate. Okay, so this is the basic principle of the energy recovery LINAC, and this makes them very efficient devices. And if you don't believe me that they work, I'll show you in a minute. So the idea is that in a storage ring, you store the electrons for many, many hours. In an ERL, you store their energy in the cavity, but the electrons go through twice and then they're dumped. And it is the energy that you utilize over and over to accelerate the fresh electrons. And as a result, ERLs have the advantage of allowing you to accelerate large amounts of beam current with linear quality beams, because I can increase the beam current without the need to provide additional RF power. But since they come from a source and they go through the LINAC ones, the quality is the same as in a real linear accelerator. So I can have small emittances, round beams, small spreading energy, short bunches, and flexible structure. Oops, now.
You're trying to get another transparency,
aren't you? Yeah. But I cannot get anywhere.
They're highly qualified technicians.
Okay, good. Now, okay. So, the LINAC we're designing, a Triumph, can be converted into an ERL. And it's pretty straightforward. And so here is the injector, this is the LINAC, and then we put the arc, we allow for some insertion devices, close the loop, and here is the dump. By the way, the dump is also good in an ERL because you dump at a much lower energy than, because the beam is decelerated the second time. So when you dump it, it's at a much lower energy than when it's accelerated. It's almost at the same as the injection energy. So the dump is more straightforward to build. And now then, if we allow to use the ILINAC as an ERL, what applications can we think about? We can think about driving a free electron laser. We can think about a terahertz radiation source to produce X-rays and as a test bed for an ERL light source. So basically what I'm saying is we could in principle cover a large part of this electromagnetic spectrum from infrared to ultraviolet and to X-rays. This is a free electron laser, which is almost like a conventional laser in that it does produce a beam of coherent electromagnetic radiation, very powerful, but it's different from a conventional laser because in a free electron because the electrons are not bound on atoms in a free electron laser. In a conventional laser, you have the gas or the liquid and so on. Here you have free electrons, which though wiggle through this alternating periodic field, magnetic field, and as they wiggle through this periodic field, they emit radiation. And the radiation they emit is in phase with the source of the electrons, and after a while, it adds coherently. And one way to add coherently is if you put mirrors on each side, so the light bounces from one mirror to the other, and after multiple passages, it amplifies. Below about 200 nanometers, there are no mirrors, so you have to come up with another trick if you want to produce light. The trick there is to have a much longer undulator, and then the self-interaction between the radiation and the electrons bunches the electrons inside the undulator, and this bunching is what makes them emit coherently. That's the other end of this free electron laser spectrum. So notice now, okay, so now you can have an ERL drive a free electron laser, and such a machine exists, and there is a proof that ERLs work up to 10 milliamps of average current. And I don't want to go into detail, but based on the principle, we have produced at Jefferson Lab up to 14 kilowatts of laser power at 1.6 micron wavelength with this based on infrared radiation. And we can have our ILINAC, we can make it to perform similarly. Now, we can also make it produce terahertz radiation, and this is a very interesting regime, The terahertz gap is yet an unexplored but highly interesting part of the electromagnetic spectrum. People start now to use terahertz radiation for multiple applications. So we can provide terahertz radiation. And here is an example of a similar machine in Netherlands where there is an accelerator, drives an undulator, over 25 to 250 micron radiation, and then if you want to have shorter wavelengths, you go to higher energy. Or you can also produce broadband terahertz radiation by just going around a band, but then you need very short bunches. Is so short close to the wavelength of the radiation you're producing. So in any event, the ILINAC can easily be configured to produce terahertz. And this is also very fascinating because we can make it even produce X-rays. Now, to produce X-rays out of real accelerator, you need to go to very high energies because the wavelength is so small. But the trick here, because we only have 50 MeV, is to do Compton backscattering. So that means we take the electron beam from the ILINAC and we use it to bounce off a low energy photons from a laser, from just a laboratory laser. And the the X-ray beam then that's coming out is upshifted by 4 gamma squared, and so you can end up having 40 kV X-rays by using a pretty off-the-shelf laser. Okay? I have done the numbers myself, so if anybody has any doubt, I can prove. And finally, we can use it to develop key components that may be relevant to design a big energy recovery LINAC light source that looks like that, with multiple undulators all around to feed multiple users. And I was playing around once to see if such a multi-GeV ERL fits on the UBC campus near Triumph, and it doesn't look too bad. So, something for later. Now, to realize all of these things, there are many, many accelerator physics and technology problems one needs to solve, because ERLs have worked up to 10 milliamps up to now, experimentally, but here we're talking about 100 milliamps. So we need to understand many phenomena, and we need to do experiments and theory and simulations. And a lot. It's a lot to study and understand, and all of them are interesting. And that means that we must be investing into younger people in the field and attract these younger people in the field. And so towards this goal, we have the initiative at Triumph to build a strong graduate student program in accelerator science and technology in collaboration with Canadian universities, such as Toronto is one of them. And we work with UBC and UVic and so on. And presently, we have in our division 6 PhD and 2 master's students working on the LINAC and other accelerator projects. We offered the first course ever on accelerator physics last year at UBC, and I have the URL to, if you want to look at the material. That was on electron accelerators, and we had 10 students who took the course for credit, about 10 audited, and we had students from 3 remote locations, and from UVic, from SFU, and from Cornell. And this winter we're offering the follow-on to this course, which is on proton and ion accelerators, and that will include the machines we have at Triumph and the LHC. And so this is just for information. And so if anyone is interested to talk to me or to Bob about this, please do that after the talk. I want now to wrap up here, and I want to say that accelerator science and technology in Canada is strong presently, and it is about to enter a new and very exciting era with these new electron machines. The Triumph programs we have are world-class. We have helped design LHC and T2K. We're participating in their commissioning, and we're participating in the LHC upgrades and many other international projects. The half a megawatt LINAC is a state-of-the-art machine. There are not very many out there of that power, so there are some challenges. But it will also be a transformational initiative, not only for Triumph, but for Canada. It offers multiple advantages for nuclear physics, material science, and nuclear medicine, and it presents a path to a LINAC-based light source in Canada, the very first one. And the technical challenges that are associated with its design are really opportunities for research in accelerator science and for education. And you're welcome to join us.